Hey there, Brandon Harvey here. I want to stop for a second before we start the show to say that I have really, really exciting news. Issue 5 of The Good Newspaper, our print newspaper filled with good news, is finally here. The Good 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 team and I could not be more excited for you to see what is inside. Honestly, we are hopeful, we're tired, we're full, and we're still in shock that we've been creating this newspaper filled with good news for over a year now. We hope that this new issue reminds you that you are not alone in your desire to find the good in the world. The Good Newspaper is a quarterly print newspaper that celebrates the people, ideas, and movements that are changing the world for the better and equips you to take action on the issues that matter to you. It's often when we as a people get to the end of our rope that we find that someone is still fighting to make a difference, still persevering no matter the time, circumstance, or political climate. Those are the stories we share in the newspaper. Issue 5 is dedicated to telling the stories of the people, ideas, and movements that have not given up on making a difference in the world. Inside our newest issue, we include stories of journalists saving democracy, Mormons showing up to support LGBTQ youth, Nigerian heroes, inclusion in the intimate apparel sector, and the global eradication of polio. And uniquely in this issue, we also give a good news story on how to plan a wedding that's ethical, environmentally friendly, and gives back. Don't miss out on all of the real messy hope inside our newest issue. Be among the first to pre-order issue 5 of The Good Newspaper. Just go to goodnewspaper.co or click the link in our show notes. Okay, now here comes the show. Most notably recognized as one of the most beloved figures from The Bachelor, season 20 for anybody keeping track, Ben Higgins is someone who is currently leveraging his platform of fame for good. The kind of good that has sparked real, meaningful, sustainable, and hopeful change in the world. And before we get too deep into this, I do have to confess, I gotta be honest, that when I started this podcast 3 years ago, I never expected that I would have a pop icon, a public figure like Ben on this podcast. For example, I just Googled his name really quick to check something before recording this, and there were like 10 articles written about him in the last few days from places like People, Us Weekly, Hollywood Life. Oh my gosh, it's crazy. This is not kind of my normal shtick on the podcast, especially because I don't watch The Bachelor. I don't watch The Bachelorette. Okay, sometimes with my wife. But anyway, I can honestly say that this is one of my favorite conversations yet because it surprised me and challenged me in ways that I did not expect it to. Here's how this podcast episode came to be. So Ben and I both found ourselves at the same conference in the same city, Plywood Presents, in Atlanta, Georgia, just a few weeks ago, and I was absolutely floored by Ben's story and how it's currently unfolding. Ben has spent years of his life living into the question of how he could use his fame and unique platform for something bigger than himself, and nothing could have adequately prepared him for how appearing on one of the highest-grossing television shows would ultimately pave the way for him to accomplish his humanitarian dreams with an organization called Humanity and Hope United and his new company, Generous. Both of these exciting initiatives you're going to hear about more in our conversation today, and we also talked a lot about travel, the nuanced burden of fame, dating, the Enneagram, our deepest fears. This one's a good one. Wild stories about Peruvian rescue zoos and getting angry about the things that matter. And also, of course, so much more. I am Brandon Harvey, and this is Sounds Good. This is the weekly podcast where we have conversations with inspiring people who are rejecting cynicism and using their lives to make an impact. Sounds Good is not your typical Three Steps to Success podcast. We don't host this podcast for the sake of leaving you with bullet points on self-improvement. We deeply believe that our lives are more complex than that. So we show up here on Sounds Good to ask big questions, dive into nuance, and learn from each other's stories. I'm so excited about this conversation with Ben. I had a blast, and I hope that it leaves you feeling less overwhelmed and more hopeful about humanity after listening. All right, here's the show. you and I are here at Plywood Presents, a cool conference focused on nonprofits and stuff. And that's why we're here in person in Atlanta together.
I've never been to Plywoods.
You've been traveling a lot.
A ton, yeah. This is, I think I said the other day, it was like 70, this is my 73rd trip.
What?
Of the year.
Of the year?
Like flight. So
oh my
segment.
Gosh.
It's getting a little ridiculous.
Yeah. When was the last time you were home?
I was just actually home. So here's a crazy thing. And please, nobody out there feel bad for me. Don't feel bad. Life's really good. But I was just home for 8 days straight, and it was the longest I have been home consecutively in Denver in 2 years.
Wow.
It's crazy.
And when you're traveling, what's most of the stuff you're doing traveling?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's changed, right? So initially, as of a couple years ago, it was kind of relationship-based and press and media. And Lauren and I were out in L.A. a bunch, kind of promoting whatever projects we had going on. So we spent a lot of time in L.A. Well, then it went into my job in software. So I worked for a software company for 5 years.
Oh, got it.
In and out of all this craziness, I kept my job. And so I'd come back and try to, work. But my job...
Were you working still like full time, or did you scale back a little bit?
I would say I definitely scaled back a bit. but I was full time.
Wow.
I was managing accounts for the software company. So I'd be traveling when I could to their locations. And so I made it all work by just traveling every week that I didn't have something else going on.
Then
I left that, and I'm sure we'll dig into this, but now I operate a company called Generous.
Yeah.
And now travel has to do with that.
Promotion, that's cool.
Speaking, connecting people to that story. So kind of, it's definitely taken its cycles and different rides, and it's now kind of spitting out in this place. But I hope 5 years from now, I'm still saying that Generous is the reason I'm traveling, and I've gotten a better hold of that.
That's great.
It's a little sporadic right now.
Yeah. Man, it's so interesting how that journey went. It was basically full on bachelor, and then back to almost a sense of normalcy in real life, and then back to something that you have a little bit more control on and that you're kind of creating. I want to bring it back a little bit because I think a lot of us have a decent idea, for those of us who follow you online, of what, your life has looked like kind of post-bachelor, mid-bachelor. But I want to go back a little bit further and talk about your childhood. Like, tell me about you as a kid. Where did you grow up?
Okay. So I grew up in Warsaw, Indiana. So it is north central Indiana. It is a town of about 14,000.
Okay.
And the closest town to us of any size is 35 minutes away. So we are an isolated, weird little community that we have five major orthopedic companies headquartered in this small town that's in the middle of cornfields. Super weird concept. And also something that I think is interesting, and it's built like it for a long time was the Methodist capital of the world.
Really?
Yeah. So you had like Billy Sunday.
Yeah.
Had his home there. Grace College, a pretty prominent.
Did you grow up Methodist?
I did.
Okay.
Of course you did.
There we go. Yeah. I mean, you have to.
Which
in the Methodist
really
capital.
Messes with you as you get older. It's like, wait, I was Methodist because everybody else in the community was Methodist. So that's,
That is interesting.
And then I'm an only child. Grew up in a great family. And then went to Indiana University. After Indiana University, I moved to Peru.
Whoa. Okay. Wait. So this is speeding up fast. This is fascinating. Before we get to Peru, which I did not know about, I want to ask what were kind of some of the pros and cons, the ups and downs, if you will, of growing up in kind of small town Midwest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the one hard part today that I'm seeing is it's very Christian. Like, to not be a Christian is to be the minority.
Interesting.
And so for me now, it's kind of deconstructing the popular,
phrase. Because it's built into your culture far more than it's a choice to
100%
to choose that.
Yeah, yeah. You don't even need a real interaction with Jesus to know, to want, to claim to know Jesus, right?
Yeah.
So it was the culture of the time. It was the cool thing that, unlike most places in the United States or in the world, it was the cool thing to do to be a Christian.
Yeah.
So if you weren't, you were definitely on the outside looking in. That was one concept of growing up in a small town. The other part, and one I appreciate dearly, is, in Indiana, we don't have a ton of options on entertainment.
Hmm.
So simplicity was what we were content with. So nowadays, like, getting bored isn't a familiar feeling to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever felt the feeling of boredom. I know what it would be like, but boredom doesn't really exist, mostly because I think my whole life was, you're either going to be really bored all the time or you're going to find a way to entertain yourself.
Exactly.
So that was something.
I grew up in a small little town too, and not quite as small, but fairly isolated still. And it was really interesting because we had to find things to do. So sometimes an activity was like, let's go to Walmart. Mm-hmm. And then that activity would turn into, well, let's buy a watermelon. And then that activity would turn into, well, let's throw this off the clock tower.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's a blast. It didn't hurt anybody. We made sure of it. And I'll never get bored again because I can always throw a watermelon off a building.
Yeah, well, it was nice of you not to hurt anybody. But yeah. we would do weird and wild things.
Yeah.
We would shoot fireworks out of places that we shouldn't be shooting fireworks out of just to see what happens. So we did hurt people, actually.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, it's just that is what I grew up with. That's kind of the world. So anything from then on out was a little bit intimidating, but also very exciting and new.
Yeah.
My worldview, I guess, was very small. But back then I didn't know any different. I was pretty content.
Yeah. So we were initially, when we were kind of planning this conversation, we thought that we were going to be talking with your good friend Riley as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Riley sounds like an amazing guy. Did you meet him growing up? Were you friends as children?
Kind of. So Riley's 5 years older than me.
Got it.
And, he grew up in the same hometown as I did. But I mean, as Riley was sitting here, he'd tell you, he was a wild child, and that isn't explaining it completely even correct. Like, he was off his rocker into the worst possible things, doing the worst possible things for many years of his life. And so we were familiar with each other, but we weren't friends until college and when I met him again. And then after college, Riley's life has completely taken, you know, now it's been how many years? 7 years for him out of college, and it's taken a complete turn.
That's fascinating.
For the better. Oh, he's an incredible guy. So we knew each other. I knew of him, but the guy I'm friends with now was not the person I knew back then.
Yeah. Who were the people who were influencing your life growing up then?
Definitely my parents.
Okay. Good relationship?
Great relationship.
That's cool.
As an only child, we spent a ton of time together as, you know, even friends, and we would do everything together. And so they had a huge impact. But the one thing they did best for me being an only child was they forced me to interact socially with a bunch of people through sports, through, you know, having friends over to the house. And they even went as far as purchasing a house on the lake so I could have friends come hang on the lake. So I was never alone. I was never, you know, I never felt like an only child because I always had a friend there pulling time or pulling space that, you know.
Yeah.
So I think
that intentionality is fascinating.
Yeah, they really did a good job at that. And so I had a really solid group of friends that I treated like brothers and sisters that I think they just were like, yeah, we're just friends. But I looked at them as brothers and sisters and extremely huge confidants in my life because I didn't have anybody else.
In some interviews you've done, you've talked about this idea of feeling unlovable or unlikable. Do you feel like you can trace that back to a moment in your childhood? Do you have any idea where that comes? Because it sounds to me like that is contrary to the relationships that, you know, your parents were so intentional about building around you.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I want to trace it back to moments or to a moment. And I think a better way, when I get to elaborate on a little bit to explain it, would be I have this weird concept that I've always felt where I'm the kid. If there's a good picture of this in a couple books, but I'm the kid on the outside of the window looking in at the party, knowing I wasn't invited and not knowing why I wasn't invited.
Mm.
And so it's more of that feeling of like, why am I not accepted? Why am I not involved? Like, what do I have to do to prove to you to like me or not?
Yeah.
And I think I remember my first time feeling it was I was in my library in elementary school. I was in second grade, and it was reading time, partner reading time. And everybody was called to get a partner by choice and go off and read. And I remember at that moment, nobody chose me. And I had great friends in my class. And I remember sitting in the corner not knowing what to do, like being paralyzed and panicked, like, I don't have a partner. I don't have a friend. I wasn't chosen. And I remember that feeling still to this day of that like immediate paralyzation of and that like heartache on what if nobody actually likes me. And I think that same feeling is the one I feel very similar to in moments today, especially when I'm not operating at my best.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting how when you're in a place where you feel a little bit less healthy or a little bit more stressed and overwhelmed, you kind of revert to those childhood insecurities. Do you know by any chance what your Enneagram number is? Do you know about the Enneagram?
Yeah, I think I'm a 4.
A 4. Okay, yep. Cool.
Yeah, I'm a 4.
The individualist?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, so is that the one, like, super, like, I function best in super authentic situations.
Yep, yep.
That's when I'm healthiest.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was funny because as I took the Enneagram test, it was that concept of when you're at your worst, you will feel like an outsider.
Yeah.
You will feel like nobody gets you.
Yeah.
Nobody understands you.
And probably, and I don't know this for sure because I don't know if I've studied it enough, but when you're maybe at your most healthy, you know, maybe all the other kids, they pick partners and you're independent and you almost get to own that. And you say, I'm unique. I'm special. You know, all of a sudden you're actually, it's not that you're the outlier in a negative way. You're the outlier in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And when you're at your worst, there's still that feeling of nobody gets it. And it's kind of the, like the joke, and obviously my life has kind of played a big joke on me because the Truman Show freaks me out to a level that like...
It's one of the wildest movies ever made.
Wildest movies ever, and the idea that everybody's in on something that you're not actually haunts me a bit.
And it, I mean, that happened to you for months of
your
life.
So I said, it's a funny joke.
That's wild.
Yeah, so then I do The Bachelor, and everybody's watching me and in on a joke that I didn't know about, right?
Yeah.
At some level. So... I don't know if it's ironic. I don't know if, again, it's just more humorous to whoever's out there watching this story play out. Who knows? But that is, like, those are the two things in my life that, like, I haven't came to terms with in my faith walk, in my personal walk, in my relational walk, is feeling confident that this isn't one big joke, which then leads me to, and I, to kind of close your question is, to my biggest fear, and this still sits with me today, is I don't understand or I don't have a firm grasp at all on what happens after death. And so that's where, like, when we start getting deep and we start functioning and asking really hard questions, it's like those, that's where my mind goes, is what if this is all it?
When you were growing up as a Methodist kid, surrounded by all these other Methodists, you know, not specifically Methodist, but more just kind of the general faith world, I feel like when you're around a lot of people who are culturally a part of this thing, sometimes when you get outside of it, it feels like a lot of people are faking their certainty. There's less faith and more presumed or assumed certainty. Everything feels black and white. And the further that I deconstruct and get out of kind of the cultural faith that I experienced, the more I go, I don't, you know, that thing that I believed about life after death, I don't know what I think about that anymore. Do you feel like that's something that you... have thought about as well, of kind of deconstructing maybe some of the certainty that may have been projected around you?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, I think you hit it. It just takes somebody entering in their 20s and seeing them leave the faith or question the faith for the first time and knowing that they have nothing to fall back on, and because of it's been a cultural thing and it hasn't actually ever been a choice and it's not really even real to them, for me to start asking that same question. Do I really believe this? Do I really know this? Do I really have a relationship with the God that I've claimed to know and felt comfortable with? I mean, I say it now as like, if you take away Jesus from me, you take away everything. Like, you want to see my world crumble, you take away the certainty that is Jesus.
Yeah.
And so that's what was happening. Slowly but surely, the things that I was holding so closely to that kind of were in relation to Jesus were the same things that all of a sudden I see my friends start to give up on.
Yeah.
And I couldn't disagree with them. Like, there was things that were they were saying was like, wait, you might be right. And if you pull that piece away, what piece is that taking away from my idea of Jesus? And where does that leave Jesus? Is Jesus just another abstract idea that isn't true either, that could be ripped from me? And I mean, this is, I'm 29. This happened probably starting at 23, and it still exists at a very like high level today. But what's happened now as I've been in it a little longer, it's became this beautiful journey where it's kind of the parable of the potter. And I feel like things are just getting chipped away, but there's still one thing that continues to stay constant. And it's, so this is like this beautiful deconstruction, which is, you know, obviously a key word today. Of
what a healthy thing to chip away at all these things that are not important and aren't real. You know, for even for people who aren't people of faith, to always be inspecting the things that we believe and the things that we're curious about and say, what if that isn't true? Like let me just double check it, because if it isn't true, I don't need to hold on to it. It's baggage at that point.
But how brutal of a process is it, especially for somebody who grows up in a town that anytime anything is questioned within the faith, there is a revolt or that person is turned against, no matter what, right? So it is a scary time too, one that we don't handle well amongst people. And so today, I think with the exploits and the things that we're doing or that I'm doing in our life, it's to try to help people have an escape to be known, to be seen, and to be heard, and to try to work people through this process that I think all of us are going to start going through.
Yeah,
I think it is a part of the times is we're all going to start deconstructing. And instead of deconstructing to the point of giving up completely, what if Jesus actually is true? Like, what if that's true? What does that look like then when all the other stuff starts to go away? For me, that's the questions I have to ask myself today.
Man, good questions. I like it. I want to hear about Peru. So yeah. How did you end up in Peru?
It's a weird story.
How old were you?
22.
Okay, so this is post-college.
Post-college, I was in a super serious relationship with a woman I loved dearly. And I thought, okay, so I'm an only child from Warsaw, Indiana, and I had this dream that I was going to go back to Warsaw, Indiana. I was going to get a great job, buy a house on the lake, and she was going to be absolutely thrilled about it. She had different ideas, and she told me that, like, I remember this moment where she kind of looked at me and said, "You've kind of lost your it factor." And I knew looking back, I did, right?
What was your it factor?
mystery, passion, a reverence for life, and a motivation to actually pursue something.
Got it. So you were kind of normalizing or flowing back to something that was natural and easy.
Yeah. I was going to live right next to my parents. That was cool, right? And so to prove her wrong, she said that, and I still loved her, I was like, "I'm going to move to Peru. You're going to graduate from college, and then I'll come back, and we'll see what happens."
Well, why Peru?
Machu Picchu.
Of course.
It was just, I just wanted to hike it.
Yep.
And my buddy was going to go. So I get down to Peru, and I realized very quickly that I was going to get homesick and that I was going to miss her. And so I fought through it. I taught English.
Do you speak Spanish?
Not very well. Okay. No, not really at all. I can't even, don't.
I visited Peru a year ago, yeah. And I had never tried to speak Spanish before. I screwed up royally.
Yeah, pretty bad.
I tried to say good job to my Uber driver because he found my spot, and I said, "Bien trabajo," and everybody in the car laughed. They're like, "That's not how this works."
Yeah, that's nothing. and so here's what gets crazy with Peru. So Peru is this like journey for me to prove to myself that I could be a person that actually was interesting, that could live a good story, and that was going to be my story, right? Mm-hmm. That was going to be what I talked about for 20 years.
Mm.
And so life had a funny way where all of a sudden my girlfriend and I, long story short, were struggling. She was going to break up with me. I wanted to get back home to see her. I didn't have money to get back home. I didn't want to ask my parents for money because I was proving to myself that I could do this. And so I went into my volunteer headquarters, the place that I went through, and I said, "I need a job. Do you have a job?" And they said, "Ben, do you have any farming experience?" I said, "My grandpa has 3 horses and chickens." And they said, "That's enough." And I'm not kidding you. I went, they drove me out to the university, dropped me off at a rescue zoo. And this zoo was a rescue zoo for giraffes, wolves, pumas, bear, condor, eagles, hawks, and monkeys. And they said, "The lady here has been working here for 20 years without a break. She needs a month vacation. We need to give it to her. She's getting older. Can you take it over?"
Whoa.
And so
How much time did you have before she was going to leave on that month?
A week. And so for a week, she trained me. And the crazy part about a Peruvian rescue zoo in Cusco was that there's no holding tanks to feed the animals. And so it's chain link fences. And so you actually go in with 2 people, one person with a stick that wards off the animals. The other person dumps the food and then picks up. So I have all these videos and pictures of me inside of a bear tank, like with bears surrounding me and pouring out their food and just running out with wheelbarrows. Like my buddy who went and helped me for 2 days went in to clean the monkeys. And the spider monkeys jumped on his back, punched him in the head, and bit him, sent him to the hospital. And so for a month of my life, I ran a Peruvian zoo. And I came back, and it was like...
That's the title of this podcast episode. Ben ran a Peruvian zoo.
Yeah, and I legitimately did. I have pictures and videos to prove it. My buddies and I from this home ran a Peruvian zoo for a month. And there's a good lesson from that, is I finally got home, and I looked back. And I thought at that time, if I allow this to be the end of my cool story, if this is the most interesting thing I ever do, and this is pretty darn interesting, I thought, I won't be content with that. I won't be okay 70 telling my grandkids this story and saying at one point in my life, this is all I did. So then that's kind of where I moved to Denver, took a job, and before you knew it, I was on reality television.
Wow, that is fascinating. That's what a thing to have this experience, be like, this is amazing, and realize that you can't let that be the most amazing thing you've ever done.
Yeah.
You did other traveling before The Bachelor, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
So tell me a little bit more about kind of some of those other trips you took.
Yeah, I mean, I think I traveled a ton with my family, Florida, Mexico, your typical stuff. But there was this constant in my life where I go to Honduras with Humanity and Hope United. And when I was 15 years old, my family and I took a trip with a church group to Honduras. And it was my first time ever seeing poverty up close.
Yeah.
Poverty with my own eyes. And it really confused me. It angered me. Not because of the poverty, because there didn't seem to be a good solution. I was having a weird God complex where I was like, why? But in my mind, as a very unintelligent 15-year-old, like, why are these people poor? What can we do about it? And it was like, nothing, right? This is just the birth lottery. They're stuck.
Yeah, we as white men in, you know, growing up in middle class and wealthy America, we have a certain level of privilege that you show up and you're like, oh, other people don't have the same privilege that I do.
Well, it's absolutely crazy. What are you talking about that you don't go eating for a meal or that you don't have clean water? I don't get it. And so I came back to the States and I went down to Honduras one more time. And still was unable to process how we fix it. And now I travel to Honduras a couple times a year with Humane Hope United because that's where Riley, who we talked about, my buddy came in, who was on that trip with me, and he came back. And he was smart enough to actually say, what if we started to build sustainable change in these communities that we're seeing to actually partner with them, to not give them anything, but to partner with them to get them from point A to point B and see them succeed because they're people too. They're smart people also. They're confident and they have they're competent enough to hold jobs and to supply for their families, and so that's where now my international travel kind of was born from was this idea of we can help and I want to partner with you to do it.
Yeah, man, I love that idea of saying, hey, these are people who, you know, they have ambitions and dreams and skills and abilities. There's just an obstacle in the way that you know, that's in the way for them that I didn't have for me. Why don't we work together to get rid of those obstacles?
100%. So that's kind of where my life now has been born from, was that one trip.
Man, okay, so you guys both come home from this trip,
mm-hmm.
and Riley has this idea. Did you have, were you kind of thinking up something, or is he just, like, the total idea
guy? Not very smart. Yeah, I struggle. So it was 7 years later, actually, when he came up with the idea.
Wow,
so
okay.
He was working in corporate America. He was working for a large financial services firm, making a ton of money. And finally, life broke him. And he kind of had started forming this idea that we could actually partner with people in the developing world and not act like the saviors and not look down on them, but just partner with them and build up these communities by just letting them know that they're loved, that they're seen, that they're heard, and that they have skill sets that can transfer over to making them successful in the healthiest of terms and the healthiest of ways. And so 7 years later, he came up with this idea. And I remember he came to me because I was so angry still that this first mission trip I took, where we went down, we passed out food boxes, and then we left. And the next year, we went down and we passed out food boxes, and we left. And the people were still the same. They're still crying. They're still yelling. They're still begging for this food.
Yeah.
And they were still hungry a week later.
Yeah, it's one week out of the year they're fed by you guys, but that's
I felt like there was no relationship there, and I was angry about it, and I had this anger still. For 7 years, I held on to it. For 7 years, I spoke about it. And Riley came to me. I remember this moment. It was at a wedding, and he said, hey, I have this idea. And we didn't know each other well at all. He goes, I have this idea.
Why do you think he chose you to tell this to him?
Because I think he knew I was so angry.
Oh.
I had been pretty outspoken about what I thought mission trips were and that I didn't like them.
Isn't anger a good thing in that way?
Like, great thing.
I love that anger can be so motivating
and
can be like, no, we've got to, something's got to change.
Something's got to change. But here is where my issue lied.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Totally.
Is there an option? Like, my idea of international travel was literally passing out food boxes. What else is there? I don't think I could even conceptualize that you could actually purchase a plot of land to build a small business, to employ the people from the community, so those people found jobs that could then, with the jobs and the salaries they had, pay for their kids to go to school. When their kids go to school, they can progress and go to college. If their kids can go to college from Honduras and make $20,000 a year even, that's hundreds of thousands of times more than their parents were making. It completely changed the trajectory of a community.
Wow.
I couldn't conceptualize that. Riley did, and Riley could, and he was the right person to do it. And so when he came to me and said, hey, I had this idea. What if instead of going down to the developing world and every time you do it, you feel guilty and sad and depressed because you feel like, oh, woe is me, and I have so much, and I need to give up everything now. What if we built an organization that every time we went down and invested into them, we went back, and they're in a little better place, and a little better place, and a little better place, until one day they're so sustainable, and they're functioning at such a high level that we could actually say goodbye to them and just be friends with them.
Put yourself out of business, and you're just, we're buddies.
We're just friends. And he goes, what if that happens?
And at that point, I just got goosebumps.
And I said, at that point, I'm in. And now we're 8 years later, functioning in three communities. And we're functioning in three communities. And moving on to a fourth this year.
Incredible.
So for the first time ever, 23 kids are going on to secondary school, which will send them to high school, which will hopefully send them all to college, coming from communities that have felt unknown forever. So for me, I guess over the last 8 years, I've seen what partnership and what true love can do. And it's changed the way I view desperate situations, I guess.
Wow. Yeah, because all of a sudden, you see this problem and you realize that there is a solution, you can be a part of it, and that one day that solution will actually result in no more of that problem.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. What if we actually strategically and efficiently invested our resources and our time and our energies into something that would be lasting for the betterment of the future and not just to fill a void today?
Wow.
And that's what Humanity and Hope has been doing.
Man.
And it's what a lot of our lives and my friend group, this is a cool thing, man. A lot of our friend groups are part of this organization. And so when we get together now, yeah, we still kick back a good glass of bourbon. We still talk life and we still celebrate. We'll still take trips. But we have a common bond that is Humanity and Hope United that allows us to speak and talk and share about something a lot bigger than ourselves.
Mm.
And it has kept our friend group so tight. When you ask, who did I rally around myself as an only child? Who is my support system? My support system are the same friends today that they were back then.
No way.
Because we've had a common bond for 8 years that isn't about just our friendships.
It's bigger
than
you.
It's a lot bigger. We have something to do, something to pursue, we have to fight injustices. And lucky enough, we get to do it as friends.
Wow. And that's especially fascinating because you've got this thing that's bigger than you. And then you went on to do something big. You went on to show up on The Bachelor. Popular guy on The Bachelor. And what I love is that this is still bigger than that.
Oh, so much bigger.
So much bigger.
It crushes The Bachelor. So here's the cool thing. So I got put on The Bachelorette because by a series of coincidences, finally an executive at my company who was a huge fan of the show, she said, I think you need to do The Bachelorette because you're a sad, sad young man. This was right post-Peru. So I came back to Denver. I was working in Denver, and I was sad, and I was lonely.
Oh, wait, because your girlfriend broke up with you.
I was single. I lost my it factor. Everything was falling apart. And so she goes, you got to go on The Bachelor. So I signed up. They called. I went on. I did that whole thing. It was a great experience. I met some had great friendships.
Wait, how did you feel signing up for this? Did it feel weird? Did it feel right?
Oh, yeah. Well, so at this point, I was pretty pathetic. And so, like, signing
like
up for
anything
was like, yeah, like, you can't, your ego and your pride can't be hurt any worse.
Is that a common factor? Maybe this isn't a good question to ask, but is that a common factor for people who show up on the show?
It's an underlying factor for many. Some people have massive amounts of confidence, which is another issue. You don't get many moderates.
No. Yeah. I mean, that's the same with, like, President of the United States. You don't get anybody who's like, I don't really think I should do this. You know, it's all the people who are like super.
Yeah.
They've got the full thing.
Big
going
personalities
on.
Can, you know, talk your ear off, which we're doing today. So I went on. That felt weird. Walked out of a limo and on The Bachelor. I remember looking around me and there's lights and there's cameras and there's people. And as soon as I walked in the house, I knew that was going to be a wild ride because my worldview was going to be changed completely. You had people from all over the world sitting in this one house dating one person. That's a whole separate category. But actually, being in a house without phones, television, books, whatever, and having to get to know your castmates and friends was a very intentional time for me to get to know people without the same belief system, with a lot more success than I had, with crazier stories than I had. So it kind of put me in my place even again.
That's really fascinating.
It broke. Yeah. I broke completely. I was already broken. I broke completely on The Bachelorette and almost was rebuilt. Because here's the cool part about that show.
Do you feel like people saw you breaking, or that more internal?
Oh, they saw me.
Okay.
Yeah, they saw me. When I break, I get quiet.
Hmm.
I don't break and react loud.
Yep.
And so it didn't make great television. And so I was breaking. But a cool thing happened during that show, and The Bachelorette is a past life for me, but this is a huge moment in my life. The whole show is based on you talking about yourself. Every day, at all moments, there are interviews about who are you, what are you looking for, what makes you tick. And I was broken, and then I was rebuilt on the show because every day I had to talk about myself. every day I had to share it, and that's where the unlovable thing came from.
Oh.
That's the moment that I said, I've never admitted this, but I feel unlovable. I feel unlikable. I've never been confident enough in myself to share it, but I had talked about it so often that I'd wrapped around it that I had tried to skirt past it during these interviews so much that finally I broke, and I just said, I feel unlovable, and I'm not okay about it. And that became my cry. That became my stance. And from that moment on, I was healing. And it walked me into The Bachelor.
And you probably didn't, you were obviously unplugged, so you couldn't see this. But as you were sharing that, the world, I would imagine they started to say, me too. You know, they say, oh, I relate with that. I relate with that brokenness. Far more than you saying, I'm strong, I'm confident, I've got it all together.
Yeah, I'm the best thing out. No, like my brokenness built a community around me that was far more than I could have ever
That's
imagined.
Incredible.
And it was really just, and what made it even better was it was out of a super authentic moment, like of me actually breaking on camera and being like, like super weird that it had to happen this way. Not ideal, but maybe it is, you know, like it sucks that now, you know, at the time I had to also talk about and confront my biggest insecurity. But then also I had to confront and talk about my biggest insecurity, and my friends and family now knew my biggest insecurity. People knew me better, actually knew me better.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because oftentimes when you build a platform, you put a certain version of yourself out there. It can sometimes be less authentic than the true self. And so then your friends and family who are seeing this but also know the real you, they're getting these conflicting things. And I love that this somehow randomly built a stronger relationship for you.
100% it did. And so fast forward a little bit, get off the show, get asked to be the Bachelor. I'm getting ready to get on a plane. And I called up my family, my friends. My very last friend to call was Riley, because we had been doing a lot of stuff together in terms of projects and business and with the nonprofit. And all of a sudden, I was sitting at the airport in B Terminal in Denver. It hit me. I said, for the last 2 months, since I was announced as The Bachelor, my whole life has been about myself. I've been answering questions about myself. I've been responding to what my love life could look like, what I dreamed of it looking like. There's a billboard in Times Square of myself. Everything right now is about me. And it felt really cool for a while. And I realized at that point, no longer was feeling cool to me. And so I called up Riley and I was like, I'm struggling, man. Like, I'm getting ready to walk into this experience. I'm getting on a plane to fly to LA to start this show. And all I know is that this whole thing has been a selfish pursuit. It's to find my wife, it's to promote me, and to make me look as good as possible so that women are attracted to me. I don't know what to do with this anymore. Like, is this what we had always talked about? And he shared with me then. I still remember, he goes, well, how about you try to use this for something bigger than yourself? And at that moment, I said, what is that thing? And he goes, well, you already have H&H. What if you just use this to promote humanity and hope?
Wow.
Like, that simple, that clear. And I walked off that conversation with so much confidence, knowing this whole thing, yes, I hope to find my wife. I dream of finding my wife in this moment. But what if this whole thing is about something a lot bigger than that? And that ties back to what you were saying earlier, is all of a sudden this community became a lot bigger than The Bachelor or Bachelorette. That became a platform or something that was like just gifted to me from a wild ride of circumstances without ever intentionally pursuing being on the show.
Yeah.
That then was handed to me, that then I think the calling was, what are you going to do with it? And there was something already there in Humanity and Hope that made it really easy to say, what I'm going to do with this is promote this. And you know, that's what we've been doing now.
Wow. So when you were on The Bachelor and you kind of went in with this mentality of having this thing that's bigger, Humanity and Hope, did you get to talk about Humanity and Hope on the air during that season?
I can't remember if it was actually ever aired.
Yeah, because I'm sure that things get cut. And
yeah,
they've got to prioritize.
But the one thing cool they let me do is I still have the same bracelet. So I have this Hope bracelet that I wear all the time. I wore it on the show, and it's from a company called Mud Love out of.
Oh yeah, I know them.
Yeah, Warsaw, yeah. Indiana. It's from my hometown.
Oh no way.
Yeah,
that's cool.
And so they gave me this before the show to remind me of my favorite word and also my hometown. I wore it, and then after the show, it was kind of highlighted on the show a little bit. People would ask me. We sold Hope bracelets for to Humanity and Hope, and it was our first large give.
That's cool.
Towards our organization.
I love that in your position, it seems like the obvious way to make this about this thing that's bigger than you is just to, you know, talk about Humanity and Hope on the show, kind of give your, you know, 10% of your time to this thing. And I love that what you ultimately got to do is you got to have every action, instead of just a few actions, have every action come back to this greater idea. You know, you had to hold yourself with a level of integrity, or, you know, have this greater kind of idea in mind, so that you could leave the show and have something bigger than just, you know, your 30 seconds on TV,
yeah,
where you get to promote the thing. You then get to move all these people that have built a relationship with you through the television towards this thing that really matters to you.
Yeah, I mean, just like my faith, it became Humanity and Hope and the pursuit of highlighting the people that we are serving in Honduras became the ethos of every, like, it became my breath. It became,
that's cool.
And it really did. Every day it was like, why am I here? Okay, I'm here for something bigger. If that's a relationship, incredible. If that's the promotion of something that I believe is really good and doing good, even better. If this is about a bigger purpose that I don't even know yet, great. But I'm going to go into this day, into this date or whatever, with the mindset of this is for something a lot bigger than even just this moment. And it helped me through. It got me through, and it led me now to where I sit today as, you know, the CEO of Generous that was birthed from, you know, the same concept.
I love that so much. And I want to talk about Generous in a minute. I feel like I remember, wasn't there something that Chris Harrison on The Bachelor told you about platform and fame and how to use it? I'm trying to remember what that was.
Yeah, so Chris is a great guy, incredibly smart, been around for a while. And I got kicked off The Bachelorette, and I was in the lobby in Ireland, and I had a glass of whiskey. I'll never forget this. And he came down, and he goes, so I was just got kicked off the show that night.
And you're bummed, I presume.
Bummed. And he's like, man, this is kind of crazy, right? And he goes, do you have any idea what's next? And I was like, well, I'm going to go back to work at my software company, and I'll move back to Denver. He goes, yeah, that's great, but you understand this is going to, like, affect your life a little bit. I'm like, I don't think it will. Like, yeah, like, I'm sure there'll be some attention. And I really was oblivious to it. And he goes, man, this is really going to affect your life in whatever capacity. And at this point, I didn't know I was the next Bachelor.
Do you think he did at that point?
Yeah, I think I think he had an idea. But he said this one little nugget that I'll keep with me forever. He goes, use this experience. And I think this transfers over to anything.
Yeah.
To enhance the life you've already been given and not change your life completely. And so
enhance the life you've already been given and not change your life completely.
Exactly. And wow. So I had a life that I had built, that I had suffered through, that I had celebrated, that had family and friends and community and a good job at the time. And what I needed to do was find whatever way to continue to keep the things that are healthy, remove the things that aren't healthy in my life, so I can pursue the thing I've always been prepping for.
Wow.
So pursue the purpose I've always been preparing for along the way and not change everything, you know, not come off the show and change and wipe out all my friendships, all my relationships, everything I had built to the point, and kind of start over as this new fame had suddenly soaked in on you. And I kept that as a filter on every decision I made.
Mm.
And it's funny because there were some really good decisions that I made after the show. And that wasn't because of me. Most of the time, because of me, they would have been selfish pursuits. But when I took a step back and I was able to process it through the filter and the lens of, is this enhancing? Is this changing? Then I could make the wise decision, even if it didn't feel right at the time. And I will tell you, I mean, there was definitely mistakes along the way, but that helped me make less mistakes, and it helped me still understand myself.
Wow.
Today. At least I think I understand myself.
That reminds me a lot of this book. I think it's Simon Sinek. It's called Start With Why. And it's ultimately about this idea of, hey, no matter what you're doing, start with asking yourself why you're doing this. What's the greater story here? And I love that you came off this show, you had this struggle with fame, but because you were able to zoom out and ask yourself this question of, hey, is this in line with kind of this bigger picture?
Yeah.
Is this, you know, improving my life that I have already, instead of, you know, starting something new? That's what got you through. I can imagine it's not that easy. It's not just quite as easy as that. What were some of the real hard parts of fame?
Oh,
because hit you hard, man. Like,
yeah.
The Bachelor is a wild, wild thing.
It's a wild thing, and it's a personal thing, and it's allowing
it's really
people
personal.
Into your most, like, intimate moments.
Because it's real for you when you're on the show.
100%
real. I think
real.
It's pretty easy to look at that and be like, this is all just, you know,
crazy,
a part of a show. But for you, it's, you know, you're in this environment. You're fully living there.
I fell in love on this show.
Man.
Right? I mean, I was engaged for 18 months from this show, and it was a real engagement. So for me, this 70 years from now, whoever my future wife is, And my grandkids ask me, you know, Grandpa, were you ever engaged before Grandma? I'll have to say yes, and I'll say in this moment, this will affect my life forever, and for the most part, in a great way. I think the issue with fame, I've came to the conclusion, and a buddy of mine, Corey, said this, humans are not meant to be famous. We're not made to be famous. There's only one name that should be and can be famous successfully. Because fame, when done in a selfish pursuit, is not everlasting, and it is a burden that we're not meant to carry. Mm. Now, granted, with a caveat there, some people, for whatever reason, are famous. So the question then is, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with that fame? Some of the issues are, obviously, the criticism and judgments. You can build a tough skin. Words still hurt. You can get a thousand things. There's a ton of studies out there on this, but you can get a thousand things nice said about you, and the one mean thing hits really deep and really
totally
hard. Especially coming from people who have known you and grown up close to you. The other piece of fame is that everybody pulls at you, right? So you're always being asked to be in a thousand places at once. And as soon as you can't abide by those requests, you've changed. You're a different person. And that hurts deep, especially because my one motto right now, where it really has been, is like, I'm not going to change. Like, I'm not going to change. I'm going to enhance. I'm not going to change. I'm going to stay true to who I was, because I know that if I do that, that my friends will hold me accountable, my family can hold me accountable and know me better. I want my friends and family to know me, and not, I don't want to change from that. And so when somebody says you've changed, or they're hurt by the fact that you don't have the time to give up for them, that stings deep. And I think that's tough. It makes you one, feel like an object, and two, feel like you're failing a lot of people.
How do you set your priorities then? How do you decide, this is what I say yes to, this is what I say no to?
Good question. You can help me answer that maybe sometime. I'm getting better. It's taken a lot of pain and hurt and a lot of awkward conversations and a lot of confusing moments and a lot of bad communication to get to a place.
You got to fail a lot to get anywhere close to success.
100%, because some of the most fruitful times in my life have been ones that I wouldn't have expected them to be fruitful.
Yeah.
So what do you enter into and what do you not? How do you choose what to? And so I go back to my good friend and mentor, Andy Stanley. When I say good friend, I just listen to him a lot on podcasts and read his books. But he wrote a great book a few years ago called What is the Wise Thing to Do? And I think outside of the lens of, is this going to enhance life or change life, I now process things through the lens of, is this the wise thing to do? Is this the wise meeting to take? Is this the wise conversation to have? Is tonight the wise night to go out with friends, or is it tomorrow? You know,
yeah.
And you try to process through that. And honestly, I bet I fail daily multiple times, even trying to do it with intention.
Wow.
So
yeah,
there isn't.
I'm the same.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's kind of a funny phrase of falling upward. You just have to keep falling upward and falling forward and tripping and falling again and trying to hurt as little people as possible along the way, knowing that your intention is never to hurt anybody. But it's hard, and I don't have a good answer to it.
From what I know of you, though, it also sounds like you've done a good job of prioritizing those core people in your life who have been around for a long time and this greater mission that you have, humanity and hope. When are the times when you don't prioritize, like in a thoughtful, wise way, when, you know, you have these priorities in your life, are there times where you go, oh, this is a moment where it's okay for me to not prioritize this? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. There are moments in my life nowadays that I think you have to be comfortable staying in your lane. I think that's how you answer that. So you have to kind of analyze life and look at it in a way and says, what are the lanes that are right now the most fruitful? What are bearing the most fruit for me and others? And then you pursue those lanes. You pursue those trees. Now, those trees could change over time, right? You go off in new directions and you see new avenues or whatever, but you have to look at what thing is providing the most fruit. I also think a practice in my life that's been big, and this is more of a tangible practice that I think has been a huge benefit to me, is as an only child, I'm very used to my time alone. I'm very comfortable in my time alone. I function best when I have some time alone, not all of it, but some time alone. And so prioritizing for me hours to be alone. And I do it in a certain way. And so it has to be at night. I don't slow down great during the daylight. So in the evenings, I pour myself a glass of bourbon. I turn off all the lights. This gets a little weird. I turn off all the lights. I have a tobacco pipe. So I have an old school, old man's tobacco pipe. I turn off all the lights. I light candles and I play typically indie folk music, Amos Lee, Penny and Sparrow, those kind of guys. And I just let my mind go. I just let my mind go. And I consciously, it's a practice.
That's a little scary sometimes. Oh, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to let my mind go. I'm going to stay busy. I don't want to process anything.
Yeah, you're always processing. I think we forget how often we're intentionally processing things. And so I just let my mind run and go. And it is scary. Sometimes I walk out of that in a very like contemplative state. Sometimes I walk out of it super refreshed and renewed with the ability to conquer the world.
Wow.
Sometimes I have my best moments in creativeness during these times.
Dang, I'm inspired.
But that is, so that is a practice that I've implemented into my life. And so I can run pretty hard as long as I have that time and that moment to just let myself be free.
Are you able to do that while you travel still?
No.
Man, okay, so that's almost the hardest part about traveling. It's not the wear and tear of airplanes. It's finding that time to be alone.
Yeah, it's finding the time to be alone. It, you know, here's a hard part about travel, and for everybody out there listening, if you travel at all. For me, I travel, like I said, 70-plus times already this year. Every place I go, it's seeing somebody new, somebody I haven't seen maybe in a while. And for them, and for me even too, it's a cool interaction, right? So let's go out for dinner. Let's go out and show you the town. For me, it's something that's happening 3 times a week.
Yeah.
So it gets exhausting. It's a constant renewing of a new relationship or a new interaction. And that gets, it wears on you a bunch. And so setting boundaries in travel is something that I'm not good at. I haven't been good at it. And so that's something that is at the forefront of hopefully a progress or a process that I'm getting better at.
I'm with you. Man, tell me about starting Generous Coffee. So you're a few years out of The Bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
You are continuing to want to, you know, prioritize this mission, this cause, this ability to make a difference that you care deeply about. Where did Generous Coffee fall into this?
Yeah, so on a trip with Humanity and Hope, Riley and I were down in Honduras, and we were around a couple older gentlemen who had kind of mentored us along the way, and they had ran a nonprofit in Honduras for many years. And we were walking around. I was still working software. Riley knew I wanted to get out of software. I knew I wanted to get out of software. I felt like it was irresponsible for us not to take advantage of the platform that we had been given by doing something different than anybody else, not just endorsing products and endorsing things, but actually like building something that was sustainable. So we already had that in our minds. And one night at dinner, one of the older gentlemen looked at us and said, "Hey, what you're doing with Humanity and Hope is actually working." Like, crazy enough, like social causes and nonprofits can actually work. What you're doing is actually working. There's a tangible effect that can be quantified. You're
specifically talking about on the ground.
On the ground in Honduras. The impact it's having. But they said, what happens if your fundraising runs out? We had gone from a $40,000 a year nonprofit to over a $300,000 a year nonprofit in 3 years. One of that is because of some hiring of some help for Humanity and Hope. The other piece of that that we can't neglect is a platform that allowed us to promote to 1 million people in a click of a button.
Yep.
And so we all of a sudden had this new kind of bubble of fundraising, not knowing when it could burst. So the guy said, "Hey, what happens if your fundraising runs out?" And we said, "Well, we'll call them new fundraisers. We'll do new campaigns." I mean, this was our legit answer. He goes, "That's not enough. Like, I'm saying, like, what if, like, your fundraising runs out? How are you going to continue to serve alongside of these people?" And we said, "We don't know. What is their advice?" And their advice to us was, find a corporation to back your nonprofit so it has a sustainable piece to it in fundraising, or build a for-profit of your own that can support the nonprofit.
Mm.
So we came back home, we prayed about it, we talked about it, and that's where Generous was born. Generous was born, and it's now my full-time job. It's the company that I am the CEO of. I operate day-to-day. Generous exists to sell products with stories behind them, mostly coffee. So we sell specialty-grade coffee, so it's the best coffee in the world that you can find that's traceable and single origin from 9 different countries. We sell T-shirts made out of plastic bottles that are created by women in Haiti, who are paid $15 an hour plus retirement, insurance, time off, and an air conditioned facility, unheard of in Haiti. And what we want to do is sell these products and build on more products that have stories behind them so that we can donate to the nonprofit. So right now we donate 10% of all revenue to Humanity and Hope United. That will always be that way. They'll always be our main beneficiary. Our hope is that we can fully fund the operational expenses of Humanity and Hope United.
Amazing.
So every donor dollar can go to the ground. And then every quarter we have 5-7% that's donated to up to our discretion to other nonprofits or social causes.
That's really cool.
So yeah, Generous nowadays is a platform and a marketplace to say we want to be as generous as possible with our time and with our resources and with our services so that we can actually make a tangible difference in the world for good.
Wow. Is that energizing for you? Is that exciting? Does it feel good to, first of all, be starting something because Riley beat you on the first one?
Yeah.
But also to be, you know,
so I'll join him on the second.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really is.
That's awesome.
It is energizing. I think the best part is it feels purposeful. So it's not always easy, right? You're still operating a company that donates a lot of our margin. There's some business issues that we struggle with. But it's energizing in the sense of it gives me a purpose, again, way outside myself. For me and my full-time job, I'm just a little vessel along with a bunch of other little vessels that help push this forward. And you're familiar with this. But this doesn't exist, and it's not successful unless we have people participating in it with us. So if we have customers and consumers actually purchasing our products who are saying, hey, I'll pay maybe a buck more for a bag of coffee because I know it's going to something good. I know it's going to something that's actually making a difference. So this is a movement. This is a group of people that I hope join together to say we're going to do something good in the purest of ways and buy products that we're already consuming that's really good products, just because we want to see the world become a better place. And I get to be a part of that. I get to see it every day. Mm. I get to wake up and answer the emails, answer the phone calls, plan our next, you know, fundraising trips. And this gets me my job. That's pretty cool.
That's so cool. And I just want to say that I think that you've been able to build a community around generosity because you have modeled for people what generosity looks like. Because you have a platform where it would have been so easy for you to just do the bare minimum of a famous person, the bare minimum of somebody with influence or money, but you took things above and beyond. And so you don't have to respond to this, but I just want you to know that I think that you're modeling that well, and that's why this is working.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that a lot, and it means a ton to hear because sometimes you forget to even compliment yourself sometimes.
Yeah.
But I believe this too, and it would go without saying, I trust Jesus enough to when he gives a command to love others and to serve others, that if I do it, it's going to be beneficial for me also personally. Selfishly, I get a lot of joy out of it, just like most do from serving. But I have to trust Jesus enough to know when he calls me to serve well and to serve intentionally and to give up everything, in quotes, for his kingdom. If I do it, like, good stuff's happening, and it is. I get to sit here with you. Like, you're not sitting here talking about The Bachelor. Like, there's no shot if I'm The Bachelor that I'm at Plywoods, first off, that I'm sitting down with you talking about life, talking about this kind of stuff. God has been really good, and not just in this, like, fluffy way that's like, yeah, God's good. This is all part of his plan. Mm. No, there's been intentional steps to take to get here. But God has been good in the sense of when he said, hey, if you serve others and you love others well, good things happen. Like, life makes more sense. For me, at least in my faith journey and what I believe, based on that commandment, life has made more sense.
I'm loving this. This is so fun. I want to talk for like 10 more hours, but I feel like that would cross a line. And so we got to wrap up at some point. And so maybe I want to just ask this for people who they want to lean into generosity. They want their lives to feel like, you know, whatever it is, whatever their platform is, they're making a difference. But maybe they weren't on The Bachelor. Maybe, I mean, if anybody was on The Bachelor and you're listening to this and enjoying this conversation, you should reach out.
Yeah.
For people who weren't on The Bachelor and who maybe don't feel like they have the same access to resources, fans, audiences, et cetera, what kind of advice would you give them on leaning into generosity in their own lives?
Well, I mean, first off, we got to start by saying it does feel daunting, I'm sure, for anybody out there. Second off, you know, I think it's a very clear and it's an easy statement for me to make. But first off, we're all the same. I just happen to have been given a platform, right? So let's take the platform out of it. I would love to tell everybody out there, and what we try to do is, and because we mean it, is you, every person listening to this is important. They were created, and my buddy says this perfectly, on purpose and for a purpose. And so if you're created on purpose and for a purpose, your purpose is incredibly important to the lives of others. There's a great parable, not to continue to make this so super Christianese, because I really don't try to live life like that, but there's a great parable out there that depicts this perfectly for me, is where Jesus left the 99 to pursue the one that had gone away from the herd. And I'm just thinking, if one life can be changed through anybody's pursuit of purpose, then that makes it worth it.
Mm.
That makes your story incredible. That makes your role in this world important. And so to do that, here's the situation. If you're listening, you're important. You're cared for, you are loved, and you are supported, but you are important. The next piece, is there something in your heart that's tugging, that's saying, I need to fix this. This is an injustice that I can't see, that I can't sleep at night, or I can't deal with, that makes me angry like it made me angry. I wasn't smart enough to process what to do about it. You probably are. So there's something out there that's making you angry. We all have it, right? If there's something out there that's making you angry, go fight it. Go fight that injustice. In the most loving, the most healthy, and the most service-filled way, go fight that injustice. Lay your own insecurities down. Lay your own ego down. Lay your own priorities down at the feet of this injustice so that you can be a part of fixing the problem. And when you do that, first off, we need you. We all need you. Second off, when you do that, I will promise you life makes more sense. It has more meaning. And it opens yourself up to a world that a lot of us never knew existed if we didn't do it that way. So that would be my command, I guess. My calling would just be, if you're listening to this, just know that you are needed. We don't get told that enough. Like, you are absolutely needed. Don't sit there and say, I don't have something to offer. Don't sit there and say, I don't have a platform to speak on. Don't sit there and say, I don't even have the brains, because I don't have the brains either. Step out and do something about what makes you angry. And man, this world could be a cool place.
Man, Ben is such a fun guy to talk to. I loved this conversation. I'm especially so inspired by Ben's passion to do something about the things that make him angry. And I want to lean into this so much more with my own life and pay attention to the things that make me want to get off of the bleachers and give myself over to a cause bigger than myself. I think we all have the opportunity to lean into that. I love how many times Ben reiterates this idea that you are needed. What if we actually believed that? I wholeheartedly believe that not only does Ben do a fantastic job of empowering others to become more generous with their time, resources, and skills, but he also models this really well in his own life. He is walking the walk, and he's not just talking. I love that and deeply respect him for it. If you're not already following Ben on social media, of course, you can find him on Instagram and Twitter and follow along with his life and the incredible work that he's up to. And like we mentioned in our conversation, Ben is actively working as the CEO of Generous, a company that sells purposeful products and then donates 100% of the profits back to nonprofits like Humanity and Hope United that are creating sustainable change. The work is so important, and they sell some really great coffee. I actually don't drink coffee, but my wife and my team at Good 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 have informed me that they really, really like it. So visit generousmovement.com. You can find out more, subscribe, shop, and hopefully participate in the work that they're doing. You can also find out more about Humanity and Hope United's mission, history, current projects at humanityandhope.org. If you're new to Sounds Good, we would love for you to stick around. You'd also love my conversation with Britt Nilsson from season 19 of The Bachelor. It was actually one of our very first episodes, and it was so fascinating. And outside of Bachelor World, I would also highly recommend our episode with Dr. Tara Rye Trent. She's an incredibly inspiring woman from Zimbabwe, and she was named Oprah's favorite guest of all time. I'm not kidding. She is incredible. You can find both of these episodes and more than 100 other episodes by searching for Sounds Good wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure that you hit subscribe to keep on getting more inspiring episodes with incredible people delivered to your phone while you sleep. And for those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast, or if this one just hit you so well, please consider supporting the show by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is created by me, Brandon Harvey, as a part of Good Good Good, a community that believes in the power of celebrating good news and becoming good news. Chad Michael Snavely and the team at CM Studio edit and mix the show, and Christy Karenbrock offers production support. You can get lots of hopeful stories on social media by following us everywhere at Good 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 CO. If you follow Good 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 on Instagram, you might just see a boomerang of Ben jumping into my arms. It is pure magic. Oh my gosh. Again, that's Good 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 CO. In addition to telling hopeful stories here on Sounds Good and on social media, we also make a beautiful print newspaper called The Good Newspaper. It's filled entirely with good news, and it looks great on your coffee table. It comes with a poster to hang on your wall, and it's the perfect piece of inspiration. Our newest issue, Issue 5, is officially available for pre-order. Check out the cover and get Issue 5 at shop.goodgoodgood.co. And on that note, that is a wrap for this week's episode. Go out and remember that you are needed. Pay attention to the things that make you angry and give yourself over to the fight against injustice for the betterment of the world. Sound good?